The Guardian.
A minute. Wow, okay.
Last week, we recorded a very special edition of the Science Weekly podcast. For the first time ever, we went out live via The Guardian's Facebook page and put your questions to Brian Cox and Jeff Forshaw.
Just signed off on the cover art, right?
How did our universe begin? How has it evolved? And what might this all mean for life as we know it?
We, with these photons, can take a photograph of what the universe was like before any galaxies or anything were formed, when it was a plasma of these nuclei and electrons. So we get a picture, a snapshot of the universe when it was 380,000 years old.
So the other idea, though, is that you can ask the question, well, if you've got a theory, inflation, which gets more and more predictive and is more and more precisely tested and is making predictions about things we can see, like the distribution of galaxies and structure of the CMB and all those things, then at some point, do you start believing in the other predictions of that theory? We're certainly not there yet.
Hello, and welcome to this very special edition of the Guardian Science Weekly podcast with me, Nicola Davis.
Before we got into the nitty-gritty, I asked for a few brief introductions.
Yes, I am... What's my title? I'm a professor of particle physics at the University of Manchester. So that's my primary research area.
And Jeff?
I'm the same. Yeah. Professor of particle physics at the University of Manchester.
Fantastic.
Brian and Jeff have also co-authored several books together, the latest of which is called Universal, A Journey Through the Cosmos.
Well, it is. At one level, it's a cosmology book. So it deals ultimately with questions of what happened at the Big Bang. And even in a technical sense, if we define the Big Bang very carefully, at the time when the universe was hot and dense, what we think may have happened before that time. But really also, it's a book about how you acquire reliable knowledge. Because you might ask the question, there are numbers like that the universe is 13.8 billion years old. Well, the question arises, how do we know with any kind of confidence? And so what the book does is it tries to start with things that you could do yourself. And one example is measuring the distance to a planet. I mean, remarkably, with a standard sort of DSLR camera, you can do that yourself, and we show how to do it in the book. And the idea is that by the time the reader gets to the stuff that you can't do, because you need a Hubble Space Telescope or the Large Hadron Collider or something like that, then at least the reader has confidence in the method that we go through as professional scientists to make statements that sound outlandish, essentially. I mean, one of the most outlandish statements in the book is, according to the theory of inflation, our entire observable universe, which contains 2 trillion galaxies and is currently over 90 billion light years in extent, was once compressed into an area of space significantly smaller than the nucleus of an atom. So how can we make that statement with any confidence? That's what the book's about.
Well, this is interesting because it brings us on, in fact, to our first question, which is from one of our listeners, Roy Bottomley, who emailed us this. And he says that he's had doubts about the Big Bang theory, especially after reading in an astronomy textbook that there are only 2 basic reasons for believing it, the cosmic microwave background radiation and the expanding universe. First, can you talk me through what those 2 ideas are? And then, you know, how sure can we be about the Big Bang?
Okay, yeah. Well, there's a third piece, which Roy missed off, which is the synthesis of the light elements as well. So I'll deal with that one first. So
and actually also the distribution of galaxies on the sky.
Yeah, well, that's...
So that's a fourth piece.
Yeah, so the nucleosynthesis, so is the synthesis of the light elements, that occurred about three minutes after the Big Bang. So the Big Bang is a time when the universe was filled with a hot gas of particles, and as it cooled, atomic nuclei started to form. So protons and neutrons stuck together to make deuterium, and 2 protons and 2 neutrons, they stuck together to make helium nuclei. So, and we can calculate using undergraduate level physics what the relative amounts of hydrogen, single protons, helium and deuterium, and actually lithium, would be if we know how many photons there are in the universe at that time. And those calculations are in accord with what astronomers measure. So that's Big Bang nucleosynthesis. the cosmic microwave background, which is its very existence, is strong evidence, and for the existence of a Big Bang. So came about. We have got to go forward. So I've just been talking about the universe when it was about 3 minutes after the Big Bang, when things had cooled so that nuclei formed. Then for the next few hundred thousand years, we've got a bunch of nuclei, which are electrically charged, a bunch of electrons, and a bunch of photons and neutrinos bouncing around. I mean, there's some dark matter particles there as well. The most important of these are the electrically charged particles, so the atomic nuclei and the electrons and the photons. Mm-hmm. And the photons, which are particles of light, are bouncing around, zigzagging all over the place inside this plasma. They're hitting the electrons and the atomic nuclei. And that means that any given photon is not travelling very far before it hits something else. So they're zigzagging around like that. Then at 380,000 years after the Big Bang, the universe had expanded more, cooled some more. It's an expanding, cooling gas, this. And then the electrons now are not zipping past the nuclei quite as fast as they used to be, and they could get captured by the nuclei. So you get a situation where atoms, the first atoms, start to form. So protons and electrons start to make hydrogen atoms, and then the helium nuclei start to pick up electrons and become helium atoms. And the result is that the photons, which were previously zigzagging around, bouncing off the electrons and the atomic nuclei, they stopped doing that because they don't have anything to interact with now, because the atoms are electrically neutral particles. They're made of electrically charged parts, but from the point of view of the photons, they're these little localized regions where there's no electrical charge. So the photons, in fact, 90% of all of the photons that were present in the universe at this time, 380,000 years after the Big Bang, just carried on in straight lines from that moment on, right? Because the universe is actually largely empty. So you can imagine a situation where you've got this cooling gas, photons zigzagging around, and suddenly the photons stop zigzagging and just start travelling off in straight lines. So photons just travelling in straight lines, And they've been going, 90% of them, in straight lines ever since then. Now, some of them are arriving at the Earth today. So if we look out, we should detect these photons which have been travelling ever since the time when they were kind of released from this plasma. If you think about what that is, photons hitting a detector is a photograph. With these photons, can take a photograph of what the universe was like before any galaxies or anything were formed, when it was a plasma of these nuclei and electrons. Mm-hmm. So we get a picture, a snapshot of the universe when it was 380,000 years old. So those photons now should be measured as microwaves on the Earth. That's the prediction of the Big Bang theory, that we should be bathed in a bath of microwaves, which can be characterized by a single temperature even. I'm giving a really detailed answer, because right? But
the simple point is that we've taken a photograph of the universe as it was 380,000 years after the Big Bang. And it's a very different universe. As Jeff said, it is very hot. It's got no stars and galaxies. That is what we mean by a Big Bang. And we've not. Yeah. So the reason we believe the theory is because we've seen it.
We see the glowing. It's not a metaphor for things. We actually see a glowing plasma. We can see it at very great distance, which means that we're looking back at that, what the universe was like close to 13.8 billion years ago. So we're getting a picture of the universe, literally, and it's telling us that it was that the universe was a hot, dense gas, not dense plasma. So that's more or less, it's like saying, I don't believe in the Big Bang. It's like, oh, well, I don't believe that you exist. And I take a photograph of you and I show it to you and say, look, I've got a picture of you.
And you say, no, right? I still don't believe it.
So it's like, I've just taken a picture of a hot, dense gas.
So I think it's fair
that's
to
that's
say
really strong evidence.
It is literally, I think, it is impossible to argue that the universe wasn't hot and dense at some point in the past. I think that's the point. We've absolutely taken a picture of that. So you can't argue that.
This story has got a nice, like we should finish off, right, talking about
probably,
these cosmic
microwaves. Because we've used the whole podcast.
I know, but we should finish. Which is, that, and this is like a major part of the book, right? Yeah. The end of the book. We kind of build to this, right? These microwaves are not perfectly uniform. So the microwaves coming from every direction on the sky, they're not exactly the same temperature. There are some regions are a bit hotter than other regions, only by about 10 millionths of a degree a difference in temperatures. It's almost perfectly uniform. But those ripples, those variations in temperature, right, mean that the plasma was a bit more dense in some places than in others. And knowing how the pattern of like a little bit over dense in the one region, a little bit under dense in another region, wind time forwards from there, and you get a prediction for how the galaxies are scattered on the sky.
I see. So you can actually use the CMB for as
yeah,
a
yeah, as an input
tool.
To calculating what the spectrum, how the galaxies, what patterns they make, and it works.
It would seem then, Roy, that the evidence for the Big Bang picture of our universe is pretty compelling. This all leads very nicely onto our second question, which came from listener Chris, who asked,
since the universe is expanding, what exactly is it expanding into?
It's a great question that gets asked a lot. And it's the point is that when we say the expansion of the universe, we mean the stretching of space, which is all there is. So the picture of a Big Bang happening in a pre-existing space, which is probably the natural way to think about it, an explosion in a box. Well, there is no box. All there is space. And actually our equations, Einstein's equations, 102 years old this year, general relativity, just tell us how the space stretches. They don't say anything, actually, about how the space came into being. It's given some space and given some stuff in it.
And that's really
how
interesting.
How does the space respond?
Because one always thinks about this idea of like the expanding balloon that people think about when they're talking about, you know, every galaxy moving further away from another galaxy and so on. But again, you still think of that balloon being sort of in a room or in a space.
So a better way of thinking about it is imagine a really big rubber sheet, right? So, and imagine putting loads of dots on it, right? Each dot is a particle. Right, the rubber sheet is going to be space. Each dot is a particle. Put those dots really, really, really close to each other on the rubber sheet. And imagine, you could even imagine the rubber sheet is infinitely big, right? So it'll take you a long time to put all the dots on. But you put all these dots onto this rubber sheet. Imagine them just like a millimetre apart. You've almost coloured in the sheet, right? That's a time just after the Big Bang. So the universe is effectively infinite at the time of the Big Bang, because you can imagine the rubber sheet being infinitely big. It's just very high, densely populated with dots. Now, imagine that somebody is kind of stretching the sheet in all the same in all directions. Then all the dots move away from all of the other dots. And that's the expansion. That's the expansion of space. So the Big Bang happened everywhere, possibly in an infinite space, and is characterized by the fact that just after the Big Bang, I mean, precisely what you mean by the Big Bang is not really relevant. I suppose it is, but you don't need it for this explanation.
Jeff's in an argument with himself. No?
Yeah. I'm going to just disappear in a minute.
A puff of logic. I was just going to say, it's one of the few times, I think, in physics where the jargon is very instructive, because it's called a metric expansion. Which means essentially what you mean is that you could imagine rulers measuring distances, and essentially the whole thing is stretching, and that's why it's called a metric expansion. And that's all we know. And I think this is one of the, going back to the previous question about when people talk about the Big Bang and suspicious even about it, I think it's really because physics doesn't claim and we have no handle on the origin of the universe. We don't possess the necessary theoretical framework. We need at least something called a quantum theory of gravity, at least, which we don't have. So really what Einstein's equations just tell us, given some space and given stuff in it, how does the space respond? And that's it. So that's the ambition doesn't, the ambition might go further than that, but our knowledge doesn't go further than that. We don't know about the origin of the universe at all.
Regardless of whether or not we ever figure out the answer to this question of all questions, the picture the Big Bang theory paints seems to, so far, hold up. And after this short break, we'll hear some of the theory's other predictions, including the inflationary multiverse.
If this theory is correct, there are Big Bangs happening now, an infinite number of them potentially. So you have an effectively infinite production of universes. That's what's called the inflationary multiverse.
We'll be right back. Before we kick off again, I wanted to point you in the direction of another podcast here at The Guardian. It's called Brexit Means, and as the name would suggest, it attempts to finally find out what exactly Brexit does mean, apart from, of course, Brexit. So if you feel like delving into the nitty-gritty of Britain's exit from the EU, be sure to join John Henley and his experts on The Guardian's Brexit Memes. To find out more, head over to theguardian.com/podcasts or search Brexit Memes on your favourite podcast app. Welcome back to Science Weekly. I'm Nicola Davis. Before the break, we heard from Brian Cox and Jeff Forshaw as they answered questions from Science Weekly listeners during a very special live recording on The Guardian's Facebook page. They gave us a brief overview of the Big Bang and importantly alluded to the growing mountain of evidence that seems to weigh in its favour, including evidence from the cosmic microwave background radiation. But whilst there are some predictions we can test in the here and now, others are harder to test. And one such prediction is that of an inflationary multiverse, meaning that our universe might just be one of many.
Nicolo Mosink wants to know, what is limiting humanity from discovering and or exploring a multiverse?
Well, this particular multiverse, I should explain what it is.
Because there are different types of multiverse, aren't there?
Yeah. For which this one, which is the inflationary multiverse. So we should say what inflation is. I mean, very briefly, we think there was a time before the universe was hot and dense when it was still there and space was stretching very fast and it was essentially empty and cold. And that period, which is called inflation, by very fast, it's doubling in size every... Was it 10 to the minus 30? Yeah.
So that rubber sheet is being pulled really super, super fast. So all the dots move away from each other really.
So you've got this very rapidly expanding cold and empty universe. Mm-hmm. That draws to a close. In doing so, ultimately you heat the universe up and make the particles out of which we are made. And that's the end of inflation and the Big Bang, the hot Big Bang. Now, the question arises, so that's fine. By the way, that makes predictions about the cosmic microwave background, the distribution of galaxies on the sky, which seem to be correct. So whether the theory is correct or not, we don't have enough evidence yet, but it makes good predictions. So that's the textbook explanation of what caused the hot Big Bang, and that gets the end of inflation. Now, the question is asked, quite legitimately, why does inflation stop everywhere at once? It seems actually more natural, and many cosmologists think this, for it to stop in patches. So certain bits of this rapidly expanding space sort of almost collapse, if you want. The inflation stops, heat up, and you get a big bang. The rest of it carries on, and somewhere else it stops, heats up, you get a big bang.
A bit like a bubbling bowl of soup kind of
idea. It is, so it's like a fractal explosion of universes. And that would be going on now. If this theory is correct, there are big bangs happening now, an infinite number of them potentially. So you have an essentially infinite production of universes. Mm-hmm. That's what's called the inflationary multiverse. How could you test that? Well, there are very speculative ideas that early on in the formation of these bubble universes, of which ours is one, they could interact with each other. And would you see that in the cosmic microwave background radiation if that were true.
So you'd see where they bumped into each other.
Yeah, so you'd see this interaction early on. Now, that's very speculative. There are some regions of the cosmic microwave background that are significantly different from others, or different enough for people to speculate, but that's very, very speculative stuff. Mm-hmm. So really, it may well be the case that we can't gather observational evidence of these things. It's just possible we could, but we haven't done. Mm-hmm. So the other idea, though, is that you can ask the question, well, if you've got a theory, inflation, which gets more and more predictive and is more and more precisely tested and is making predictions about things we can see, like the distribution of galaxies and structure of the CMB and all those things, then at some point do you start believing in the other predictions of that theory? We're certainly not there yet, but general relativity would be a good example. I mean, we believed in the existence of black holes, or we felt strongly that they may be there. They're a prediction of the theory, and it turns out now we've been able to observe them subsequently. But you might well think that general relativity does such a good job that they would be there anyway. You might come to accept that this prediction, even though you can't see it, is valid. So, but that's almost a philosophical argument. I don't know what you think about arguments like that.
Well, that's really interesting, because we just had a question come in from Andy Mitchell, who says that if the multiverse theory is not falsifiable, how is this concept stronger than any given religious belief?
The point is, I tried to say inflation is.
Yeah.
So inflation makes predictions. So then the add-on bit about whether does inflation imply that there's an inflationary multiverse, certainly not at the moment, but might it do in the future? That's possible, I suppose.
It is interesting though, isn't it? So one other aspect to this, why we can't get evidence for these other little mini big bangs that have happened all over the place, is that they're probably too far away. Mm. So we've got the entirety of the universe that we can see might just be some tiny little corner of our own bubble where inflation stopped. You know, we might be trapped in some tiny little part of a bubble, and that bubble itself is so far away from all the other bubbles that we would just never get evidence.
We're riding away from each other. The distance is doubling in these models every 10 to the minus 37 seconds, or it was early on in the history. So this is a very rapidly expanding potential to create universes if this picture is correct. But I think that the questioner is correct at the moment, that this is that bit, the inflationary multiverse, speculation.
All science that's developing has like things that have not been measured yet. Mm. And so it doesn't mean that you should not think about them. You say, no, this science predicts this. It's like, go and try and find it. And if it's some things are harder to find than others, that's the situation. It doesn't make the theory less good. I mean, in this particular case, we have a possible prediction. It's not the case that inflation absolutely mandates the existence of this multiverse. Mm-hmm. But we have the possible prediction of this multiverse of universes that may be really difficult to see. And Brian's point, I think, is a good one. Suppose you have a theory that predicts 10 things, 9 of which you've seen, right? And they're all totally different. It's like, and the 10th thing you could never, ever see. Do you believe in that the 10th thing has happened or not? I mean, it's kind of metaphysics, that, but it's saying it's religious belief that you believe in it. It sounds a little bit excessive, right? Yeah. I mean, you've got evidence, right?
90% of your
theory. At the end you can say, well, on balance, I think it's probably true, right? But you don't get too excited because you've not got direct evidence of it.
Very quickly, one thing I'd just like to point out is that, so inflation did make predictions, which were subsequently seen. One of them is the fluctuations in the cosmic microwave background, which were predicted by the theory in the 1980s before the observation that the fluctuations were there was made, and also the nature of the fluctuations themselves are in accord with the prediction, which was made before that was measured. And that is quite important. It does lend some credence to this idea of inflation.
Something else our listeners wanted to know about was what the future might hold.
One of our questions comes from Lei Mayan, who asks whether you think our universe will end up going into another Big Bang, will expand forever, or will just reach a steady size and stay there. Jeff, do you want to jump in on that one?
Yeah. Well, at the moment, it appears that the most distant objects in the universe are accelerating away from us. So the rate at which the universe is expanding is increasing. That surprised a lot of people that that's the case. And by now, the evidence is quite strong. It comes from different directions.
It's still relatively recent that we found that out. I mean,
It's
1990s. Initially.
Yeah. And the first evidence came from things like the age of the oldest objects in the universe, globular clusters. And there's been evidence from the CMB as well now, and direct observation of exploding stars, supernovae. And they all point to there being a source of energy in the universe, and it's energy that matters as far as controlling the expansion rate of the universe, which is a bit weird. So ordinary material stuff would cause the expansion rate to slow down. Mm-hmm. But it's accelerating, and but there is a means to generate that accelerated expansion in Einstein's original equations. We know that something like that exists in the universe, but we don't, or appears to exist in the universe, and it's driving this accelerated expansion. It's one of the big mysteries as to precisely what that is. It's called dark energy, typically, or the cosmological constant. So it's driving this accelerated expansion. But what you think about what that means for the future, and it will do so into the future. This thing will come to dominate as the universe gets more and more diluted, because as it's accelerating an expansion, all the particles move further and further and further away from each other. So the Milky Way and Andromeda actually are on a collision course. They'll kind of collide together and make like a big like super galaxy. And like the local group or some other galaxies, they'll kind of all stick together. But all the other galaxies, which are not kind of under the gravitational pull like that, mm-hmm. will be accelerating away from us. And eventually they'll be so far away that we'll never be able to see the light emitted by them. So you can imagine cosmologists in the very far future, when they look out into the sky, they don't see any galaxies at all.
So the lights are going to go out.
They just see the stars of the local, their local group. And then they have no information. They can't do cosmology anymore. So they have to read all the textbooks that hopefully have survived from
the lights literally go out. Because within a galaxy, the star forming rates fall over time. It's certainly dropping in the Milky Way now. And that's just because matter isn't created in galaxies, but it gets locked away in black holes and neutron stars and stellar remnants. It doesn't all get returned into the galaxy to be recycled into new stars. So ultimately, in every galaxy, the lights go out. And then we think that matter itself is not stable over very, very long lifetimes. We think, we look for the decay of protons, for example, and we have a lower limit on it. We don't know how stable they are, but we strongly suspect it's not stable forever. And even black holes, we think, will evaporate away through Hawking radiation. So in the end, you do get, if the physics stays as we think it is now, mm-hmm. you end up with the heat death, which is a universe full of radiation at the same temperature.
Let's just talk there a bit about dark energy. We've got a question here from Beth Hayward, who asks, what progress is being made in the area of discovering the nature of dark energy and dark matter? Is there anything exciting in the offing?
I mean, I say dark matter first is the easiest challenge, I think. We're looking for it. We might still have the possibility of making those particles at Large Hadron Collider. Well, we do still have the possibility of doing it, so we may make them. And we have underground detectors that are looking for the dark matter that, if indeed it exists and it's a particle, we're pretty sure it does exist, and we're pretty sure it is some kind of particle, I should say. But we don't know, we've got to see them. Then they're in this room, they're rattling around, they're everywhere. And so we look for them bumping into other particles. It's very low probability they'll do that, but they should do.
So we don't see the particles, we see the traces of them interacting with other particles.
You see them hit a particle that you can measure in the detector. And so we're looking for it, and we may well see that. So that's an easier problem. I'll let Jeff, the dark energy is probably the hardest problem in theoretical physics and points to a fundamental misunderstanding or lack of understanding.
So dark matter, let me just say a word about dark matter, because it... often when I talk about dark matter, people are like, "Oh, look, dark matter, dark energy. It's like Emperor's New Clothes. You don't know what you're talking about." But the dark matter is, we know an awful lot about it. We measure it. We map it. There are maps of dark matter. So because you can measure it. There's something there that is gravitationally bending light, for example. The very idea that the only things that there should be in the universe are the ones that we can see, right? No, is a ridiculous idea to me. I mean, the fact that there should be some stuff in the universe which we've not yet seen and figured out what it is.
What you're saying,
then dark matter is very natural.
But what we mean by stuff we can see is stuff that interacts with light.
Yeah, that's what I was saying.
So we mean
electrically charged stuff. The dark here is that it doesn't interact with light. That's where the dark comes from.
That's basically it.
Yeah.
It can be anything else. It may well interact through what's called the weak nuclear force. And we know of particles called neutrinos that behave just like that. It's not neutrinos, the dark matter. We know that. So Jeff's right. We know exactly where it is. We know a lot about its properties. And we can see it in the sense that it deflects light through the curvature of space because of its mass. But it doesn't interact directly with the light. So it's hard to pin down.
I mean, it is conceivable that we're misunderstanding gravity in some way, and that this particle doesn't exist. So it would be really nice to actually measure it at somewhere like the Large Hadron Collider, to make it and measure it under those, or measure it in one of these detectors that Brian was talking about. And there are a lot of people who are seriously thinking about possible ways of modifying gravity. But the simplest explanation is just that there is for these phenomena is that there's some particles that we've not seen yet, which is not a very bold statement, really. the dark energy is much more slippery, right? that we could have seriously misunderstood stuff with that, because really we don't really know what it is. So the progress that's been made to understand it better, probably the most progress in the next few years is going to come from astronomical surveys of very high precision. So mapping out where the galaxies are in the universe, mm-hmm. so producing a really good map of the galaxies, and looking at recessional velocity is related to how far away they are, and the nature of the dark matter, the precise nature of the dark matter affects that
dark energy.
Dark energy, yeah, affects that that map. Mm. So we might be, we would hope that we would be able to say whether or not dark energy is consistent with the cosmological constant that Einstein admitted is possible, or it's got something, something possibly a bit more interesting. So there are two possibilities at the moment: cosmological constant, not cosmological constant, and we may be able to rule out on ruling one or the other with these very accurate maps. But it's a really tough thing to do.
The picture we have of our universe and its early beginnings is far from complete, but the universe continues to have a fascination for all of us, whatever our age. It's a point neatly encapsulated by our final question that was asked by Facebook Live viewer Gabriella Hampton on behalf of her 5-year-old son. The question was, how many stars are there in the universe?
The thing is, the estimate keeps changing. I mean, even last week, I think, there's a new probe called Gaia, which is measuring the star motions in the Milky Way with high precision at the moment. And already, so I've always said, the number of stars in the galaxy is in the Milky Way is about 200 billion. And now I think, as of a couple of weeks ago, it's now 300 billion, because we seem to have underestimated. So it's a difficult thing to count the stars in a galaxy. But it's of order, so a few hundred billion in a typical galaxy like the Milky Way. Yeah. And the number of galaxies in the universe, well, at the moment, the number is 2 trillion. It was 350 billion until about a year ago, and now it's gone up. So it's something like hundreds of billions of galaxies, each with hundreds of billions of stars in them. In the observable universe, the bit we can see, which is most likely a very small patch of the entirety of everything. But in the observable universe, you've got it. It's something like 100... Let's say 100 billion multiplied by a trillion.
Well, I think on that note, it's time to wrap up. Thank you again to Brian.
Special thanks this week to Brian Cox and Jeff Forshaw.
Been watching us on Facebook Live, and
we'll include a link to their latest book, Universal, which is out now in paperback, in the episode's description on the Guardian website. We'll also include a link to the full video from our Facebook page, where you can hear more of the conversation, including Brian Cox on the search for extraterrestrial life.
For the Guardian Science Weekly.
Thanks also to all of our listeners and viewers who sent in their questions. I'm Nicola Davis. This is Science Weekly.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.